most recently how COVID-19 exacerbated their impact on food systems. Based on these findings, global food security has decreased for the second year in a row. James Collins Jr., Chief Executive Officer of Corteva AgriScience, said, "Sponsoring the Global Food Security Index is part of Corteva AgriScience's long-term commitment to growing progress." He added, "With food security declining again, we all must heed the urgent call to renew our collective commitment to innovation and collaboration. Our future is only as secure as our food system, and agriculture is at the heart of it. Together, we must better support global food security." This year, the Global Food Security Index formally includes natural resources and resilience as a fourth main category. This edition marks a significant shift in methodology, revealing food systems' resiliency against climate change. The sub-indicators under this category include food import dependency, disaster risk management, and projected population growth. The 2020 index also measures gender inequality and inequality-adjusted income as sub-indicators for the first time in its history. For the third consecutive year, the North America region is leading the world in food security. Europe is a close second, accounting for 8 of the top 10 countries. Using the new methodology, Finland tops the list, while last year's leader, Singapore, drops down to 19th place. Ireland retains a second-ranked position, whilst the United States of America moves to 11th place. The new methodology underscores the importance of climate risk management and its link to food security. Pratima Singh, project leader for the Global Food Security Index at the Economist Intelligence Unit, EIU, said, "Incorporating the natural resources and resilience category as part of the main index highlights the impact of climate-related factors on food systems and food security," adding, It is critical that climate risk becomes core part of the dialogue on food security. We hope this will drive much-needed action on developing policies that can build a stronger and more sustainable global food system." The Global Food Security Index, GFSI, 2020 shows that rising temperatures and global warming have a direct impact on the agricultural sector and on the food system. Highly volatile agriculture production in countries like Australia, Norway, and Sweden demonstrates the risk that climate change poses to agriculture and to food production. The Global Food Security Index finds that agriculture production has become more vulnerable in 49 countries compared to the previous index period. While climate change is notably creating new challenges, farmers are still required to anticipate demand for volume of food. With the increasing impact of extreme weather conditions on demand, there is a great need for staple crops that are more tolerant to extreme weather and can thrive with limited water as well as in poor or limited soil. Corteva AgriScience is innovating to make crops more resilient so they can thrive in poor soils and better withstand extreme temperatures, droughts, and new infestations. The company's precision agriculture technology delivers whole farm solutions, empowering farmers to use data to solve problems in the field. It's all part of helping farmers and building a more secure food system. The Global Food Security Index 2020 shows creative supply chain solutions powered by new technologies can help alleviate challenges to food security and farmer well-being. A successful mobile technology program can help farmers to anticipate market demand and respond in time, as well as connect them with the right resources, the right suppliers and markets. The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed existing vulnerabilities in the global food system. Although the various stakeholders have been quick to respond, the lockdown restrictions and resulting economic fallout have had a disproportionate impact on those living below the poverty line, with limited, if any, social protections. In the agricultural sector, smallholder farmers, the majority of whom reside in rural communities, have suffered a significant loss of income, as lockdowns have prevented market access and interrupted the planting season. Corteva AgriScience is working with supply chain partners to anticipate shifts in global demand and thus continuing to help ensure a reliable food supply. The company's mobile software puts market data in farmers' hands to enable them to make better business decisions. Corteva AgriScience's advanced seed breeding methodologies provide the right high-yielding potential products, and agronomic advice helps farmers put it on the right hectare for the right market. The Global Food Security Index shows that sustainable farming is essential to food security and farmer productivity. The index shows that the global food systems have been under strain even before the COVID-19 pandemic began to spread, and many countries struggling to increase productivity, adapt to a worsening climate, and reduce environmental harm. In 2020, both Australia and the United States were impacted by high levels of land degradation, ranking 81st and 63rd respectively on the Land Degradation Indicator. According to the index, Latin America is suffering from irregular rainfalls and above average temperatures between June and July 2019 led to a second consecutive year of crop failure in the dry corridor spanning Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador and Nicaragua. Corteva AgriScience is driving a more responsible food system with products and services to produce what our food system demands whilst conserving resources and sustaining the land. The company's biological solutions give farmers additional tools to address pressures from pests and disease whilst helping meet consumer demand.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome to the Bulletin. Thank you for joining us. My name is Amina Taylor from the British capital. Now we begin with a troubling story because activists and human rights organizations like the Palestine Solidarity Campaign are raising the alarm amidst fears that Facebook will make Zionism a de facto protected category. Already an army of trolls and numerous algorithms are busy removing pro-Palestinian posts on the site. This is all part, some say, of a stealthy campaign launched to stamp out criticism of Israel by defining it as hate speech. Bianca Rahimi went digging and has this report.
Zionism is a political ideology, but Facebook might give it the same protection as race, nationality, and sexuality. Hundreds of millions across the globe define Israel's Zionist regime as the last apartheid on earth. It is a very sore historical subject, and Zionism lies at the heart of the discourse surrounding it.
I would say, like, in an academic setting, if you tried to write a paper on what's happening in Palestine and you didn't mention Zionism or Zionists, you would fail that class, right? There's no matter what your political outlook is, you have to have that discussion of Zionism to talk about accountability.
The Palestinians live in an open-air prison. Illegal settlement expansions continue, and Israeli soldiers and settlers attack Palestinians with impunity. Hundreds of activists, intellectuals, and artists have signed a petition that says making Zionism a protected category would prohibit Palestinians from sharing their daily experiences and histories with the world, be it a photo of the keys to their grandparents' house lost when attacked by Zionist militias in 1948, or a live stream of Zionism settlers attacking their olive trees in 2021. And it would prevent Jewish users from discussing their relationships to Zionist political ideology. But that is the direction Facebook is heading. This is former Director General of Israel's Justice Ministry, Emmy Palmer. On her cyber unit's watch, censorship of Palestinian social media posts increased 500%, and Facebook complied with around 95% of Tel Aviv's requests to delete Palestinian accounts. In 2020, Facebook hired Palmer as the first member of its oversight board tasked with ruling on content ethics. Since then, pages focusing on Israeli violations against Palestinians and the Arab normalization deal signed with Israel have recorded an international decrease of 50% of user reach.
I think Facebook is a very political entity, and it is subject to pressures. It's one of the big power players in the world, and we would not expect it to be immune to those pressures. What it needs to have is systems and an ideology in place which resists them. It's up to groups that object to this to mobilize and to tell Facebook that they will simply, and I think we can, go elsewhere. There are other platforms.
Facebook is under pressure to adopt a controversial definition of anti-Semitism drawn up by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, which literally defines and outlaws criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic. Scholars of anti-Semitism, Palestine and Israel relations, and Jewish and Holocaust history say this is dangerous. But in the end, it seems that the power lies in the hands of Facebook's 2.7 billion users. Bianca Rahimi, London.
All right, well, Jeffrey Ben-Nathan, author and political commentator, joins us from Middlesex. Good to have you, as always. So why do you think Facebook appears to be leading the charge in what some are seeing as censoring pro-Palestinian content?
Well, I don't know. I really don't know. I'm not an expert on Facebook. I am on it, Facebook, but really don't know. I should admit straight away, don't know how to use it and don't use it. But there is a changed atmosphere completely in the Middle East, and I suspect that this is part of the change that's taking place. In as much as people that go onto Facebook are anonymous, if they are at all, I suspect some of them are, and terrible things are said, there is probably on both sides, but there is a case for policing the whole affair and for making sure that that what's said is reasonable. And from the point of view of the Palestinians, it's quite right that they should be able to criticize Israel, and their supporters should be able to criticize Israel. And the Jewish state has managed so far up to now, with all the criticism that it's had, it seems to have managed very well. And I'm not sure to what extent it's behind all of this, I don't know. But I suspect that there is a new atmosphere in the Middle East, and people want to make more accord with Israel and the Jewish state.
Doesn't this set a dangerous precedent, some might be wondering, because social media giants may well be deciding what people should be consuming without any kind of democratic process? Or is it simply they're a platform, they can do what they want, if you don't like it, go elsewhere?
Well, it may well be that, but I entirely agree with you. I think it's quite wrong that the social media giants should be the arbiters. And I think it's wholly correct and wholly right that government should intervene and police the social media. It's their job to do that, and not the social media to be the arbiters themselves, even with Trump. I mean, God knows that what he said on social media was sometimes outrageous, but it wasn't up to Twitter to make that decision. And I think it's time for government to intervene. Australia has tried. They seem to have weakened, but they're on the right foot. So I agree with you, yes.
All right, we'll leave it right there. Thank you so much, Mr. Jeffrey Ben-Nathan. As always, a pleasure. Now, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has condemned the cruelty of sanctions imposed by Western powers on his country and has called on the European Union, the United Kingdom, and the United States to follow the recommendations issued by a top UN human rights expert following her recent visit to the country. Ahmed Caballo has more in this report.
On Monday, the 22nd of February, the European Union extended unilateral coercive measures against Venezuela and added 19 Venezuelan state officials to their sanctions list for their participation in Venezuela's parliamentary elections on December 6, 2020. The EU's move appears to be in defiance to a recent report published by a top United Nations expert urging the bloc to lift sanctions against the oil-rich nation. The report published by Elena Duhan, the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures, found that economic sanctions imposed against Venezuela had limited the government's ability to provide public services and resulted in a shrink in their revenue by up to 99%.
It was incredibly damning for the UK, which has frozen roughly $2 billion worth of gold in the Bank of England since around last year. And we know about a year's worth of medical and food imports to Venezuela cost roughly $2.6 billion. So the UK has basically wiped out the equivalent of Venezuela's total imports for food and medicine budget.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro addressed the United Nations top human rights body on Monday and criticised the interference from the EU. He also cited Duhan's report and added that imposition of sanctions had deprived his country of at least $30 billion in cash.
Los secuestradores de los activos,
the kidnappers of the assets and resources of the Venezuelan state, have shown great cruelty, even in the circumstances of a pandemic, disregarding the appeals of the international community, the Secretary General of the United Nations, the higher commissioner, and especially the Venezuelan people. And they have increased economic aggression, generating a humanitarian crisis in a deliberate and premeditated manner.
Yet according to independent journalist John McAvoy, it's unlikely that the concerns raised in the report will be listened to, particularly as the report has thus far largely been ignored by Western governments and mainstream media outlets.
Now that the UN independent expert on unilateral coercive sanctions has said that these sanctions are having a massively deleterious effect on the civilian population, they're restricting Venezuela's means to import medicine, to import basic goods that would improve the human rights of the Venezuelan people. The mainstream media has simply ignored it. Virtually nobody in the entire UK press has covered this.
Top UN human rights expert Elena Duhan was unequivocal in her recommendations that the US, the UK and the EU, as well as corresponding intermediaries such as the Bank of England, needed to unfreeze the assets of the Venezuelan Central Bank and allow for the purchase of food, medicine, vaccines and other essential items. Yet the early indications are that her message hasn't been taken on board by the very entities she was trying to reach. Ahmed Cabello, London.
In some other news, the Turkish government has accused Greece's military of harassing a Turkish research vessel in the Aegean Sea. On Tuesday, it was revealed that four Greek F-16 fighter jets had allegedly harassed and flown close to the Turkish research vessel, the TCG Jesma. Turkey has explained that the ship was carrying out technical and scientific research in international waters. Without adding any more information, Ankara said it had already responded to the alleged intimidation. These moves come just weeks after both Turkey and Greece agreed to enter into resolution talks over energy rights in the disputed Eastern Mediterranean. Now, Iran has stopped voluntary implementation of the IAEA's additional protocol, which allows the International Nuclear Agency to carry out short-notice inspections of the country's nuclear sites. The move comes weeks after Iran warned it would scale back compliance with the JCPOA If the US did not lift its illegal unilateral sanctions from the Islamic Republic. Speaking of the move, the three European signatories to the 2015 accord, France, Germany and Britain, expressed regret over Iran's decision, saying that it reduced transparency measures from the IAEA. Now, the body and Iran will still continue to implement the necessary safeguards agreements for the next 3 months. Well, Elijah Magnier joins us from the Belgian capital. Good to have you with us. It seems there is a lot of conversations here about who should blink first, but is it not time for the US to step it up?
Thank you for having me. Yes, it is up to the US to start and take the initiative, because it is the US that violated the law by withdrawing from the JCPOA in 2018. And so far from Biden, we just heard palabras and words that his intention is to return to the JCPOA, but so far he hasn't done any significant step. And Iran promised to halt more or less 30% of compliance with the allowance of the inspector to visit on surprise, on short notice, all the nuclear sites. And on 26th of March, is going to take a further step by stopping completely any access to the inspectors. Now, it is up to the Biden administration to make the move, and Europe is trying to put the ladder to Biden to come down the tree that he climbed on when he promised that he will return to JCPOA. And if not, Iran is going ahead as promised, as warned, with increasing its nuclear capability. And it's up to the world to abide by the international law, and particularly the UN Security Council 2231.
Now, we've just heard representatives there of France, etc., kind of wading in on this deal. How can they be more helpful in this discussion, if that's indeed what they want to do?
Well, if Biden doesn't want to sound like he is weak by returning to JCPOA in front of Saudi Arabia, in front of Israel, and all his warmongers within the administration and political parties at home, Europe is offering the possibility to move forward and say, okay, I'm lifting the sanction. If Biden is not going to lift the sanction, nothing is going to happen. And here in Brussels, we understand from the European that they have no power over the American decision, and they cannot violate the U.S. will, not the international law. They're ready to violate the international laws and not abide by their commitment to the JCPOA, but they can't do anything but trying to persuade Biden to return to the JCPOA and assist to the negotiation by saying, okay, this is my will, this is my agenda, this is my roadmap, and I am willing to lift the sanction, and then we can start talking. If he doesn't lift the sanction, Iran is not willing to talk and will continue its step one after the other.
Now, if there is not a return to this deal, does it essentially mean that future relations between the U.S. and Iran in terms of diplomacy are irreplaceably strained?
Well, already since 1979, the relationship is not good, and it's Swiss embassy that is looking after the connection between the diplomatic connection between the U.S. and Iran. But there are many other players like Kuwait, like Oman, like Qatar, who are trying to mediate and make sure to de-escalate and to reduce the tension. But at the end of the day, as the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, we can go toward the 60% and nothing can stop us. But he never said we're going to go toward the nuclear military weapons. What he's saying is we're going to increase our capability and we will not wait for longer than we have waited for the U.S. and Europe, because Europe is in the same basket.
Indeed.
Europe is not doing anything.
Right, we'll leave it there. Elijah Magnier, thank you. Now, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has urged world leaders to fight the COVID-19 pandemic and address its broader impact on the most vulnerable, During the global conference, Ms. von der Leyen also added that leaders such as France's Emmanuel Macron must help in the fair and equitable distribution of a COVID-19 vaccine. Her comments were made during the launch of a Recovery Plan for the World, a campaign run by international education and advocacy organization Global Citizen, which is aiming to end COVID-19, resume learning, and kickstart a global recovery. The online event was attended by world leaders, politicians, and artists. To Malta now, where police have arrested three men suspected of having supplied the bomb which killed a Maltese anti-corruption journalist back in 2017. The arrest comes just days after a suspect accused of carrying out the killing, Vince Muscat, agreed to a plea deal and allegedly agreed to provide police with vital information about the case. Multimillionaire businessman Jorgen Fenech, who is known for having high-profile political connections, is suspected of masterminding the crime. Daphne Garunia Galizia was killed by a remote-controlled car bomb in 2017. She was known for investigating high-level corruption, including contributing to the 2016 Panama Papers.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Richard Sudan, it seems every time we talk, there is another unfortunate and, in this case, solemn anniversary to mark. This, the death of Aubrey. Tell us more.
That's right. The world is marking the one-year anniversary of the racist murder of Ahmaud Arbery, and decent-minded people all around the world have actually been sending messages of solidarity to Arbery's family. Now, the murder of Ahmaud was actually described as a racist lynching done in cold blood, even by President Joe Biden with his documented history on race relations. Now, Georgia in the United States has a long history of basically lynching black people in cold blood, and Gregory and Travis McMichael and Roddy Bryan basically hunted Arbery down in this fashion, and they chased Ahmaud down. Ahmaud was running for his life until he literally could run no more, and then he had the choice of either turning around and fighting Roddy Bryan, who it's believed is armed, or fighting the McMichaels, who were armed, and Ahmaud bravely chose to fight for his life, and he was gunned down with a shotgun as a result. Now, the murder basically reflected white supremacy in two ways. First, in terms of the three men that killed him, but also in the collusion, really, of local state apparatus, which almost saw these men evade culpability altogether. And actually, Ahmaud Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, actually had something to say about the structural racism in the United States. And I just want to roll a clip from that.
More than failed. And not more so by our local government failed Ahmaud. Like I said, the officers that were on the scene, they saw the video. The Monday, the Tuesday, the next week, the sheriff knew that there was a video. If I didn't take a stand, this case would have been closed and gone.
Isn't that sad though, Richard? If she didn't do anything, we wouldn't have known about this case.
That's the reality of racism in America, and actually she's also now filed a federal lawsuit against the three men that killed her son. And also, just a bit of context, Ahmaud can actually be seen moving, still alive, in the initial footage in the aftermath of the killing. And actually, you know, the McMichaels were heard to use racist language towards Ahmaud after they shot him. And of course, this is one of the cases that sparked mass protests around the world. And now these three men are now in custody in a pre-trial situation. We've yet to hear of a trial date confirmed, but they are all facing murder charges.
Online reaction, Richard?
Let's go first to Val, who says, Ahmaud Arbery, Tamir Rice, Elijah McCain, Trayvon Martin, and many more innocent black people were killed for just walking down the street. Ahmaud Arbery was out jogging. Winston says, 1 year ago today, Ahmaud Arbery was hunted down and murdered by white supremacists, also known as the true American pastime. And Audrain tweets, Ahmad Arbery's mother broke down in uncontrollable tears, remembering the one-year anniversary of her son's murder. When will this madness end?
And for those who've been following anything we do here in this segment, it seems the madness hasn't ended and it's not going to end anytime soon, which is why it's so important to just keep that light on to your next story, a little bit closer to the British capital, this one.
Exactly, Amina. So Prime Minister Boris Johnson of the so-called United Kingdom is in the headlines again. But the story really is the fact that Boris has failed the nation has been trending now for the second day. And in a nutshell, Boris Johnson is being absolutely hammered online over every single conceivable issue imaginable, mainly about his handling of COVID-19, his lockdown ease, some people saying he didn't lock down when he should. You know, this Prime Minister is really viewed as the UK's Donald Trump. That's how many people see him. And I think, Amina, just looking at some of the online reactions and judging the public mood, we may well see Boris Johnson, vacating office very soon, which really begs the question, who is going to take his place? Now, I think, Amina, a little prediction here. I think you're going to see Conservative and Tory-leaning newspapers probably start to hype up Rishi Sunak or Priti Patel very soon. But, you know, Boris Johnson is in deep political problems. We should make no mistake about that. And I looked online and I couldn't see any real positive comments about the Prime Minister. He's being mocked and ridiculed mercilessly. And a lot of people are making the point, really, that, look, this is just a Prime Minister who's basically a failed journalist. And what did we really expect from his premiership, which was predicated almost entirely on getting Brexit done? And now, of course, people are realizing what Brexit was really about, which was more a project about British nationalism, many people would say, and the UK is not really going to see too many tangible benefits, I don't think. And Boris Johnson is now the sort of centerpiece, the target of much of this kind of public angst about many of the problems we're seeing in Britain right now.
And I think by putting all his political eggs in the vaccination basket, if this doesn't turn the corner for him and things don't start easing down in June, I think we're going to have a very different political climate, a different political landscape. To your tweets, Richard.
I think you could well be right, Amina. John Gibson says, Boris Johnson's a pathetic liar. That's what he is. Fish D says, the roadmap could well turn out to be Boris Johnson's most reckless moment of all. And Tory Liars Destroy Lives says, any other government would have to try pretty hard to be as inept and corrupt as the current Tory chaos. Hashtag facts matter.
All right, final words on this. He's going to ride this one out as long as he can, surely.
He can, but I think if the public mood is anything to judge by, he could well be gone towards, I would say, the end of this year. But you're absolutely right. He's going to try every conceivable trick imaginable to stay in office for as long as he can. Boris Johnson wanted to be Prime Minister for his entire life. He's not going to go without a fight. But I'm afraid the tide is definitely turning against the Prime Minister, if social media is anything to go by, Amina.
All right, well, they say be careful what you wish for. And for the man who wanted to be king, well, here you go. All right, that is where we leave things. Thank you so much for being with us. Stay safe. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
U.S. interests lie in creating instability and chaos in the region. As for the sanctions, the Western Front and our enemies are obliged to stop the malicious move, imposing sanctions against the Iranian nation immediately. As for the sanctions, the Western Front and our enemies are obliged to stop the malicious move, imposing sanctions against the Iranian nation immediately. Of course, I have said many times and would like to say again, that they should lift sanctions and we too should plan and organize our economy in a way that we will be able to run the country, despite the existence of sanctions. I have repeated this time and time again, I'm saying this again now. We should assume that sanctions will not be lifted. Of course, their effects are gradually being mitigated. In other words, they're turning into something of little effect, but even assuming that sanctions will be there, we should plan the economy of the country in a way that we will not face problems with the coming and going of sanctions and with the games that the enemy plays. This is very possible. This is not something that I'm claiming is true. Rather, this is being said by sympathetic economic experts. They say that it is possible and that domestic capacities exist in abundance. We announced this in the form of a policy. The policies on the economy of resistance, which should be pursued in a serious and intensified manner. Therefore, this is the definite response to sanctions. That we should do this or not do that, this is idle talk. Sanctions are an act of treachery and a crime against the Iranian people, and therefore, they should be lifted. This is one issue.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. Grant me faith to be stronger.
As for our regional presence, they constantly question Iran's presence in the region. However, the Islamic Republic is obliged to behave in a way that its friends and allies in the region will be supported. This is our responsibility. Our presence signifies strengthening our friends and our allies. We should not do something to undermine the Islamic Republic's loyal friends in the region. Our presence is like that, and it also leads to stability. It has been proven that the Islamic Republic's presence helps eliminate the causes of instability, such as the issue of Daesh in Iraq, various matters in Syria, and the like.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Democracy, directed by Swiss filmmaker David Burnett. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is John Rees, who is a writer, broadcaster, and author. Now, Democracy is a documentary that gives you an amazing insight into the legislative process at EU level, offering a compelling story about a handful of politicians trying to protect society in the digital world from the dangers of big data and mass surveillance. And following 2 long years full of pitfalls and accelerated by the upheaval of the Snowden affair, parliamentarian Jan-Philipp Albrecht and European Commissioner Viviane Reding worked together for a new law on the protection of personal data.
Many people say data is the new oil, the oil of the 21st century. But if you think about how oil has transformed our lives, data is going to do the same thing.
Der Knoten meines Lebens. Wenn ich da als Minister sitzen würde, würde ich auch jemanden zuhören, der keine Krawatte trägt. Es geht darum, dass sie eine Datenschutzverordnung verabschieden wollen.
Data protection is a fundamental right, and the companies have the duty to explain what they do with our data.
European citizens are concerned that their personal data may be misused.
That causes jobs to leave the European Union.
Our life is about data. Data are money.
Surveillance is about managing populations, managing people.
That's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy.
It is our responsibility to get these rights in place.
Who do you think would like to stop the dialogue?
Well, I think we know the usual suspects.
Well, first of all, warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary tackles an important issue of our time and gets behind the scenes of the European privacy debate. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Democracy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, fascinating and important subject, but for me, sadly, deeply unpersuasive treatment. I mean, it's by nature, you know, if you're going to follow lots of bureaucratic meetings with people kind of, you know, arguing over very, minutiae of clauses and things like that, there needs to be something to grip an audience. And, you know, first of all, it's filmed in this kind of very kind of nondescript greyish black and white. But I guess the director would say he's probably trying to avoid sensationalism or dumbing down.
Well, some critics have actually praised the film and its efforts and its monochrome sort of sequences and the black and white feel to it, because it is an incredibly tough subject to film and follow through. Perhaps the director made it for new audiences watchable. You know, well, it's a tough subject.
If people get something out of it, that's great. All I can talk to is my experience of it, and I do think this is an issue that, because it sounds quite boring, people do switch off. And I think unless you're preaching to the converted, if you want more people to be engaged in this issue and you want them to sort of sit up and take notice, you need to get their attention.
Just to bring in John here. John, are we as a society largely ignorant about data protection issues? So surely this film can help persuade people of this argument.
Well, it'd leave people going away with the idea, maybe I must find out what it's about. And also the critical thing you see here is what happens when corporations that are privately assembling data for consumer management, which is one issue, an important issue, flips over into state access to that data. And that's what the Snowden case, of course, revealed. And that's
are
the only
picking up on that.
Yeah, and that's the only time when the film really kicks off.
Ladies and gentlemen, the citizens are very worried. 72% of European citizens are concerned that their personal data may be misused. Our reform will assure a high protection to the individuals. A single set of European rules on data protection, fit for the digital age, valid everywhere across the European Union, on the basis that the personal data belongs to the person.
When I became Commissioner for Justice and responsible for the protection of the citizens, I knew at that moment I had to reform the data protection rules. Without trust, no digital economy. So it is in the own interest of the politicians who want to develop our economy and of the industry who wants to take advantage of the personal data of the individuals that clear rules are established so that citizens know, all right, I can hand out my data. That is exactly what we need. Because in this new digital world, no service can function without the data. The data are needed.
So that was the importance of data protection. Lee, what else does this film tell us about the significance of data protection? What arguments does it make, and you know, why is it so controversial?
Well, I mean, all the arguments that Vivian Reading makes and Jan Philip Albrecht, they're all absolutely valid, and they're things that we should be concerned about. But I would question one of the things she says there. She says, without trust, no digital economy. Now, the fact is, a lot of people, as they say, don't trust it, but actually, we all are kind of complicit because we so easily give our consent and agree to things and share our details that actually the digital economy seems to be doing quite well. And the issue is, why are we so pliant and why do we give our consent so easily? And this is the thing. A film like this or anything that discusses this, whether it's a news program or a documentary, should be trying to alert us and give concrete examples of what is happening with this data and why we should be more concerned.
Surely this is a testament to the documentary then. It's just simply following sort of the bureaucratic process and that bringing to light and to this issue to the public eye, whereas who would otherwise not know about these issues?
Well, again, I think its heart is in the right place. It wants to do that. I just don't believe it does. What this does is follow very diligently and, you know, obviously taking a long time, the trail, you know, the process of getting these laws applied.
So, John, for viewers who haven't seen this documentary, could you help contextualise this issue of data protection? Why is it such a huge issue?
Well, what for the first time in history you've got is major corporations being able to track, not by name, and that's important, but in general patterns, consumer behaviour at quite a detailed level. And there's a question mark about whether or not that should be, the degree to which that should be able to be done, and certainly able to be done without consent. And that's an important issue. But, and I have to say, that clip is very revealing, although the filmmaker doesn't make very much of it, because the film is framed as if it's a battle of, you know, kind of libertarians against the power of the corporations. But that's not what the EU does. And in fact, what the EU does is it excludes cowboy capitalism so that the really big guys can agree on the rules and compete on that basis. That's what it does. The European area.
So who else can we rely on then to ensure that these checks and balances?
Well, we're coming to that, because the people who are actually the heroes of this story and the person who ignites this film is Edward Snowden, and those are the people who should, you know, Jan Philip Albrecht, all right, nice guy, green, trying to do his best, thinks the EU is a marvelous institution, wants the corporation to behave reasonably, fair enough. But that isn't really the person that smashes open this whole debate, even in this film. And he's supposed to be the hero of this film.
Interesting point you made. And we'll touch on Snowden again, as I mentioned, a bit later on. And Lee, if I could just quickly ask you, what were some of the obstacles that Jan faced then in trying new lobbying efforts?
Well, I mean, you know, this basic assumption that citizens are consumers and therefore we should be treated as such. It's like, therefore, you know, what's wrong? We're going to give you what you want. This is a shortcut. If we know, you know, the things that you're interested in and where, you know, what your daily existence is about, we can help facilitate that. Now, obviously, that's a very positive spin on that. The downside is, you know, it's about commerce and it's about selling things to people. And unfortunately, the kind of the positive benefits seem to get easily swept aside in the rush to kind of make sales.
I think everybody is aware that that the lobby on this file is one of the most intensive that we've seen for a long time.
This has been the most heavily lobbied piece of legislation in recent years. Why is it causing so much stir and interest?
It is important to understand that European companies are a major part of this growing internet economy. Some of the most successful global internet companies to date are European.
The conflicts between the giant internet companies and the rights of the individual in terms of protecting their data online. What were some of the conflicts, if you could shed more light on that, between these companies and data protection?
Well, I mean, aside from the whole commercial angle, there's the surveillance side of things, and the idea that if, as John was talking about, if the companies share this information with the state, what use is that information going to be put to? So in the UK, you know, famously, the sort of Snoopers Charter that came, you know, was announced November 2016, and is maybe hopefully going to be
passed into law last year.
Yeah, exactly.
Also known as the Snoopers Charter.
Yeah, exactly. So that whole idea is, if you get, someone in charge, I mean, the US is perhaps a good example, who looks like they're cracking down on kind of, you know, freedom of information and things, then maybe that information is going to be misused. And this is a big worry for people. It's like, if you can pinpoint, maybe without specific names, but, you know, being able to identify people by so many characteristics, where does that, it's basically, where's this going to go? Mm-hmm. And if you're allowing this stage's, you know, gradual sort of erosion, then, you know, it's open to abuse in the future.
Mm-hmm. And John, so this film implies that giant internet companies such as Google, Microsoft, Facebook, etc., Yahoo, for example, that they have invested interest in data against data protection. They don't like to be associated with these sorts of laws and things. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, I think every capitalist corporation just wants as much freedom as possible to gather as much information about its customers as possible and use it how it likes without legal regulation, transparency or oversight. I think that's a kind of given, and not just in this industry, by the way, but right across the board. I mean, big corporations are some of the most secretive bodies in our society. I mean, probably only the state secret service agencies are more secretive than giant oil companies or giant car companies, and of course industrial espionage is a thing. So, you know, I think we have to take that as one of the ways in which a competitive profit-seeking system works. That's what they want. That's what they want it to do.
So how can an individual, take on sort of a giant corporation like that?
You can't, individual. The imbalance in power is too great. That's why they are collective, powerful collective entities. And if you're going to take them on, you need powerful collective entities on your side as well. Mass protest movements, trade union organisations, labour organisations. That's why that kind of.
But why don't we see this then? Do you think there's an ignorance then on the public's part?
No, I do think that, and this film kind of underlines this. Yes, there's massive corporate lobbying going on. I think at one point in the film they say 96% of the lobbying that took place over this piece of legislation was from corporations and their various front organisations. And that's an interesting thing, because that will be happening not just on this bill, but on every conceivable piece of labour legislation that you can think about. I think people are concerned about that. We heard the figures, but you know, there are some things that are a lot closer to home than whether or not Google has got your consumer preferences, your health service, your wages, your welfare provision. These are things that are cutting into people's lives like right now and matter about fundamental things in their lives. If huge corporations get your data, perhaps they'll missell you things, perhaps they'll try and send you things you don't want, and have things about you don't know about, and that's bad. But corporations don't have the power to arrest you, try you, imprison you, deport you. That's what the state can do. And so when the state has these powers, this is a holy order different threat. And I think we've seen that the reaction to these two things by the public is different as well, because they understand that distinction.
So more sinister issues beneath the surface then.
Edward Snowden revealed that secret surveillance activities went far beyond what anyone thought possible.
Companies like Google, Facebook, Apple and Microsoft got together with the NSA and provided direct access to the back ends of all communicating systems.
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures. That's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy.
The Guardian's editor-in-chief testified before Parliament that only a fraction of the leaked files have been revealed.
It's about 1% of what we were given. Only 1% of the information in those files has now gone public.
Yes.
The EU Justice Commissioner has spoken about the leaks from Edward Snowden and says that new legislation must be put in place to protect the privacy of EU citizens.
Anybody who uses digital equipment is put under some form of surveillance. And that seems to me is something which cannot happen without consent. It cannot happen without the consent of populations. So my message to the lawmakers is, please protect us.
What's the strength of this documentary, Democracy, I think, is that it gives you an insight into the privacy battle before and after the Snowden revelations. So you sort of see that journey and struggle. Lee, how was the revelations the game changer, and did it make the EU go into more gear and make more progress?
I mean, funnily enough, the appearance of Snowden in the film mirrors his kind of, you know, explosion and effect in real life. It kind of jump starts, makes it personal, gives you a concrete example, and actually helps you understand and get a grip on something else. The impression the film gives is that that gives a new impetus to their fight. It gives something concrete, and they can point to that example of Snowden and say, you see, this is the sort of thing we're talking about. If this can happen in this case, it can also happen in these other cases. Therefore, that's why our, you know, this issue is so prevalent, and I, you know, the film at least gives the impression that that helps win the argument that they're putting forward.
So finally, we get to discuss all the Snowden revelations now in this part of the show. John, what did you make of the revelations, and was it a game changer for the EU and sort of the battle for privacy?
Yeah, I think Lee's absolutely right about this. I mean, it was a game changer, along with others, Chelsea Manning, WikiLeaks, and so forth and so on. But that's the point, really. These are things that come from the heart of the surveillance state, and they're very, very shocking. And they have a political effect about, you know, this doesn't come out in the film, and it should do, but they're about real things happening, about people losing their lives with illegal operations in Afghanistan and so forth and so on, about the treatment of prisoners by the United States and so forth. These are deeply important issues which did have a political effect, and they're about surveillance by the state. And this film doesn't really acknowledge quite what a big shift this is. It says it's a game changer in terms of their legislation, but we've suddenly moved from a film which is only discussing kind of corporate interest in data collection to the question of the state. And it's not surprising to me that that's where the film really becomes interesting. If this film had been 25 minutes long, the last 25 minutes of what impact did Edward Snowden have on privacy legislation going to the EU, that would have been quite interesting, and it is actually quite an interesting documentary. So yeah, it changes gear, but it changes political focus and doesn't really quite acknowledge that it's doing that or why that might be important.
I just wanted to read an example now of Snowden. One of his revelations is that the NSA and the GCHQ here in the UK have far-reaching powers, particularly this country, that undermine privacy and security, variety of means, so unlocking encryption used to protect emails, for example, banking and medical records. And what's also controversial, which the film mentions, is that, you know, why should the US have the power and jurisdiction to spy on people in Europe? So one of